a memo from the CNO, which is the Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, and this is apparently going out to the entire fleet. And here are some quotes in this order from the Chief of Naval Operations to the rest of the United States Navy. Sailors live our core values every day. However, recent events highlight that the U.S. Armed Forces, including our Navy, service members, civilian personnel, and all those who support our mission, are not immune from the corrosive effects of extremist ideology and conduct. What could that extremist ideology and conduct be? Well, it certainly can't be Islam, because we know that when guy went into Fort Hood and shot up all those people, murdered them, that was a workplace incident. There were no Purple Hearts awarded. That was not a combat wound of anything. It was just a guy who just kind of had a bad day, I guess. So we know it can't be Islamic extremism. We certainly know it can't be things like Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, the destruction of property, the destruction of order, arson. No, we know that can't be it either. So I'm wondering what kind of extremism is the United States Navy talking about here? Extremist behaviors and conduct, even from only a small percentage of our force, violate our core values. They are detrimental to good order and discipline. They reduce warfighting readiness and degrade the toughness, trust, and connectedness we are building in our sailors and teams through our Culture of Excellence campaign. In that last sentence is encapsulated every single worthless, meaningless, virtue signaling nothingness this kind of pablum, this sort of regurgitated sense of cliches that we need to use at all times. If you really want to talk about a culture of excellence, you might want to look at what happened on October 25th, 1944. When a small group of destroyer escorts and destroyers escorting a bunch of paper-thin escort carriers turned and faced the entire might of the most powerful Japanese surface fleet assembled during the war. When one guy named Ernest Evans and a destroyer named USS Johnston was running from Yamato and other major battleships and cruisers and destroyers, 37 of them, something like that. Then USS Hearman turned around and USS Hull turned around, both destroyers, and even a destroyer escort named Samuel B. Roberts, half a destroyer, turned around. And these four paper-thin ships went and engaged and turned them away. That's what I would call the Navy's culture of excellence. But when I hear something like this from the current Chief of Naval Operations, what he's talking about when he says the culture of excellence is he's talking about things like diversity factors and inclusion and not so much readiness or preparedness, training, not so much aggressiveness, not so much courage, not so much honor, not so much integrity. Those are old-fashioned ideas that kind of sailed away with Ernest Evans and the Sammy B and all the rest of those people. Now we're talking about things like sustainability, inclusiveness, diversity. How green is our Navy? The CNO goes on to say, as an initial step in what will be a continuing and focused effort to address this problem, commanders and commanding officers will conduct a stand down prior to 2nd of April 2021 for all military personnel and Department of the Navy civilians to address extremism in the ranks in accordance with guidance contained in references A and B. The stand-down is there to, quote, ensure that service members and civilian personnel clearly understand the damaging effects of extremism and begin developing more effective, sustainable, told you, ways to eliminate the corrosive impacts extremist activity can have on our force. And now, in a moment of irony that is unsurpassed by William Shakespeare in any of his plays, we find the following sentence. As public servants, we took an oath to the Constitution, and we will not tolerate those who participate in actions that go against the fundamental principles of the oath we share, particularly actions associated with extremist or dissident ideologies. Service members, Department of Defense civilians, and all of those who support our mission are entitled to an environment free of discrimination, hate, and harassment. Now, I've read the Constitution. I've read the Constitution that every single naval officer swears an oath to protect and defend, and nothing in that Constitution anywhere is there a protection against harassment, hate, or any of those other things. There is, however, pretty clearly marked in the Constitution. In fact, I think so clearly marked that of all the amendments to the Constitution, they decided to put it first, was this idea of freedom of speech. So what the CNO is doing, what the Chief of Naval Operations is saying is, the Navy, in its commitment to its constitutional responsibilities, will no longer tolerate any kind of free speech that anybody could consider harassing or hateful. See how that works? That's our Navy in action now. That's the modern Navy. But it gets better. At minimum, the stand down will include a group readministration and reaffirmation of the oath of office, oath of enlistment. Did I read that right? I don't know what else that could mean. I hope I'm wrong about this. Is the Chief of Naval Operations saying that every single member of the United States Navy is going to have to swear and re-swear their oath? The oath that they took to become either commissioned officers or enlisted personnel, the oath that they already swore, they're going to have to take that oath again? Why? Is there going to be a change to it? And if so, what is the change going to include? This is a mortal insult to anybody who's serving in the United States Navy. We have decided that we're going to crack down on domestic extremists who might be voicing opinions contrary to the current administration's policies. And in order to enforce this, we're going to have to ask you to swear your oath again. You know, I can remember one time in history when officers were required to swear an oath again above and beyond the initial conditions of their oath. And that was when the German officers were required to swear an oath directly to Adolf Hitler. If you want to say that I just lost the argument by bringing the Nazis in, that's fine with me. I lose that argument all the time. The responsibility of leaders at every level, obligation to report, obligation to investigate, remaining alert for signs of extremism and then intervening. It also includes listening sessions focused on our core values, our culture of excellence, and the Task Force One Navy report. Yes, that's what I want in a Navy. I want a Navy whose commanding admirals are willing to conduct listening sessions to make sure that our core values, which are in line with our culture of excellence, are maintained at all times. This isn't a Navy. This is a rehabilitation center for drug addicts. That's what this is. This is a fat camp. This is what you do when you have extremely delicate people who are trying to rebuild shattered self-esteem. It's a 12-step program. It's what it is, basically. Only without the discipline that a 12-step program brings. But it's got the ring, you see. It sounds serious. It sounds naval. We've put a Task Force One, not only a task force, we've put Task Force One. It is the most important thing in the Navy right now, is inclusion, equity, and suppression of domestic extremism, which you might notice is not defined anywhere in this article. CNO's, the Chief of Naval Operations direction, is that every commander or commanding officer will continue to conduct listening sessions and get it into their battle rhythm. This is where the hard work of establishing trust and connectedness starts. How does that work exactly? Getting a listening session into your battle rhythm. See, that's another example of this weenie basically trying to take terms that mean something, terms that have earned the reputation that they have. He's trying to apply military terms to something that is designed to not only weaken the military, but to essentially destroy it. So how does that work, Mr. Chief of Admiral, beg your pardon, excuse me, sir, my lord. How does that work? How do you work listening sessions into your battle rhythm? I'm very curious to see how that works. See, I've been aboard a U.S. Navy destroyer. I've been aboard USS Spruance, DDG 101, and I've been in the CIC on the Spruance. I've also been on board a nuclear submarine 600 feet below the surface of the Pacific Ocean, moving at 20 knots. I was on board USS Pasadena, and I saw how that submarine worked as well. I have been in the combat information centers of both a destroyer and a submarine in the United States Navy, and I, for one, I'm not aware of how a listening session is going to be integrated into the battle rhythm. I can see a horrible world where it's something you do to take up the limited free time that sailors have and turn whatever moments of relaxation they might have gotten otherwise into some kind of harping, kind of lecturing, Karen, mega mart. But working it into your battle rhythm, how does that work? we're sitting here in the CIC. All of a sudden, we see backfire bombers coming in from the north. All of a sudden, they're launching cruise missiles at the fleet. They're calling vampire, vampire, 600 inbound cruise missiles. But you know what? The most important thing is to work in a listening session now into our battle rhythm, because we don't want to overstress the personnel. We don't want anybody to become too stressed. And we certainly don't want at a moment like this, especially a moment like this with the missiles inbound, we don't want anyone's feelings to be hurt. So now is the time to really listen, and for the commanders to especially be careful not to issue commands in a kind of an abrupt or authoritarian or patriarchal manner. That's the most important thing. Just let those ships sink. Let those people die, as long as we do it politely. And as long as we do it with our eyes on the woke horizon, then that certainly would be the lesser of two evils. As sailors, we must strive to be inclusive, creating an environment where every individual understands that they are a valued member of the Navy team. This is an all-hands effort. See, I always thought that the job of the Navy would be to say something along the lines of, as sailors, we must strive to be courageous, honorable, dedicated, tough-minded, ingenious personnel who is dedicated to the mission of keeping the ship afloat if possible, but if we have to lose it, we lose it in order to defeat the enemy on the high seas. That's what the Navy should be talking about, in my humble opinion. That, to me, is the core Navy priority. If you're going to have task force number one for the United States Navy, if I were the Chief of Naval Operations, or the Secretary of the Navy for that matter, I would say that Navy task force one would be dedicated to the idea of making sure that every single naval combat vessel is at maximum readiness, maximum lethality, maximum efficiency, maximum morale, and will go out there and put enemy shipping or submarines at the bottom of the ocean where they belong. That's what I would be doing if I was the Chief of Naval Operations. That would be my pep talk. That'd be pretty much it. Ladies and gentlemen, we are counting on you to continue the incredible history of heroism, courage, and victory that the United States Navy is bequeathing to you. Your job is to go out there and put enemy steel on the bottom of the ocean. And if you need inspiration for this, I would remind you a quote from Admiral Halsey, who was remarkable man, had his faults, but nevertheless, when it came to really getting down a pithy answer to what the Navy's all about, it's going to be tough to beat Halsey. When he was asked if the United States Navy could share the Pacific with the Imperial Japanese Navy, Halsey said, well, of course we can share it with them. We'll take the top half and they can have the bottom. It concludes with, our Navy must be a shining example. Your Navy was a shining example of an organization centered on respect. Inclusive of all. Respect in the Navy used to be earned by leadership. Respect in the Navy used to be determined by men like Ernest Evans, who pretty much single-handedly decided that he was going to sacrifice his own life, the life of his crew and his ship, in order to protect the six paper-thin escort carriers that had been entrusted to him to protect. That's what used to generate respect in the Navy. You'd earn the respect of the crew by leadership in such a way that gave you the impression that the captain was not only willing to share all of your risks and all of your hardships, but that furthermore, you were extraordinarily fortunate to have a captain who was so acutely aware of the situation, a captain who was so on the job, on the ball, on the spot, that you not only thought you were going to win, you knew you were going to win. That's what respect in the Navy used to be. You can demand respect all you want to, but my experience has been that whether you're in the Navy or not, anybody who says that we demand respect is somebody who's in for a rather big surprise. The United States military was the first institution in our culture to fully integrate after World War II. It was a directive issued by Harry S. Truman, and over a significant amount of resistance, I might add. If there's any organization in the country or in the world that most effectively deals with people of diverse backgrounds, it's the United States Navy. Even more so than the Army or the Air Force or the Marines. If you're on a ship, you're out there for 6 months, and you don't have a place to go to get away from this kind of stuff. I was enormously pleased, relieved, and proud when I was on board both of those vessels that I mentioned earlier to see that there was not, to me anyway, the slightest sign of any kind of difference between people other than their natural rank, and on a submarine, even that kind of goes away. Everybody on that submarine, everybody on board USS Pasadena looked like a piece of America. You found people of all different races, all different colors there, different religious, different economic backgrounds, and they're functioning as a team because they're driving a steel tube through the water 1,000 feet below the surface in front of 160 million watts of electrical power generated by decaying uranium. Up in the front of the boat are torpedoes designed to sink enemy vessels. This is not time to be looking at the guy next to you and saying, I wonder if this black guy can handle loading that torpedo thing, or I wonder if this white guy is going to save me if there's a fire on board the ship. That kind of thing doesn't exist in the Navy. And to make it exist, for the sake of this public relations posturing and all of this other that is basically happening, is to degrade the Navy and to degrade the armed services. And I will close this with a very, very simple story that I heard from a lifelong CPO, Chief Petty Officer, a senior enlisted man in the United States Navy. I talked to him. He'd been in the Navy for 23, 24 years, and he said he's getting out. And I said, why? Well, he said, it used to be fun. I could probably just stop right there. It used to be fun. He said, what's not fun now? I asked, well, it used to be when you came into a port, you were granted liberty. Liberty means freedom. And that meant that if we arrived at port at 6 o'clock on a Friday evening, and we're sailing at 8 a.m. on a Monday morning, we'd better be back on the ship by 8 a.m. But what happened between these two time periods was entirely our own. If we wanted to spend money like drunken sailors, that's what we could do. We could spend money and we could get drunk. It's not like that anymore. Really? This was a bit of a shock for me. He said, nope. Now, when you go to shore leave, it's no longer liberty. There are certain hotels that you're required to check in at. You can't just stay anywhere you want to. There are places that are off limits, and you have to basically call in every few hours. That's basically what the Navy's become. And this was 5 years ago. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The sword of America, the defensive military capability of the United States, is unmatched anywhere in the world and continues to be. And our adversaries, domestic and foreign, all know that in a straight-up fight with any member of the U.S. Armed Forces, especially the United States Navy, a well-commanded Navy commanded by officers and enlisted personnel who are determined to win the fight will win the fight and win it decisively. And if you cannot break that sword, then all you have to do is weaken the sword arm and weaken the will to use it, because the most magnificent sword in the world is utterly useless if the person wielding it is a 98-pound weakling filled with neuroses and who hates himself.
War Room, Pandemic. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Right. I will tell you, this Arizona story, like I said, I did not expect to be seeing it, to be covering it again tonight after we covered it last night. It is obviously strange. It's laughable in lots of ways. But the president, former President Trump, put out a statement today lauding this and talking about how this was going to reveal the truth of the 2020 election, and citing a whole bunch of other states that are also going to now do this to reveal the truth of the 2020 election. And he's still maintaining this fantasy that he somehow won and that Joe Biden isn't really the president anymore. He's not the legitimate president. What the Arizona Republicans are doing here, this process by which they are bastardizing the actual secure election from November 2020, and they're going to produce some result that says that it was some other fraudulent thing, will be used by the Trump part of the Republican Party and the Trump right to cast doubt on the 2020 election among their most fervent supporters in a way that none of their failed lawsuits in the past have been able to do. They got the actual ballots and they handed them to conspiracy theorists who say that, you know, QAnon is the mastermind or whatever it is that stopped this, that they need to use to stop the steal. And all, I mean, the craziest parts of the pro-Trump conspiracy theory world have the actual ballots and are going to declare that something different happened in the election in Arizona than what really happened. And that will become a lie that they try to live on and build on for a long time to come. You watch. This is a ridiculous story that will become very dangerous in the long. I'll be right back.
Okay, you're saying now you're in the war room. It's the 27th of April, year of our Lord 2021. It's Tuesday now, with almost 50 million downloads the podcast, and that is Joe Biden wandering around with a mask on after a CDC. I mean, a guy by himself, outdoors, had the vaccine. I just can't, his handler is clearly not around. So we're going to have Peter Navarro. By the way, breaking news out of Maricopa County. The judge just said something about the process and the procedures. We're going to try to mix up. We're going to have to mix up our guests. We have some power guests coming on, but may have to get Boris Epstein back with breaking news out of Maricopa County. We're going to get to all that. We're going to get Dr. Peter Navarro in here, the author of the Navarro Report that talks about the steal. Captain Bannon, the President of the United States, as Rachel Maddow said, he's been sending some thunderbolts out. Folks should understand, he is quite engaged in this process, okay? Quite engaged in this process to like a lot. What did he say? What did he put out this afternoon?
His statement this afternoon said, "The radical left Democrat Party has gone absolutely insane in fighting the forensic audit of the 2020 presidential election scam right now taking place in the great state of Arizona. They sent a team of over 100 lawyers to try and stop it because they knew what the result of the Arizona Senate-sponsored audit will be. And it won't be good for the Dems. The audit is independently run with no advantage to either side, but the Democrats don't want to hear anything about it because they know that they lost Arizona and other scam election states in a landslide. They also know the Arizona state legislature approved virtually none of their many election requests, which is totally unconstitutional. The people of Arizona are very angry, as are the people of our country. If we can't have free and fair elections, we don't have a country. The audit must continue. America deserves the truth."
Okay. Also from Maricopa County, this just came out from the hearings. This is from the judge, Judge Martin. He's the new judge after the original judge got recused by our own side. Believe it or not, that was an unforced error. Okay. This is what Judge Martin said. "The Senate has the authority to audit, but must balance with constitutional rights of voters." He added later, this is a quote, "I'm not persuaded that rights of voters in Maricopa County are being protected." The judge said that this issue is central to the case. We're going to get Boris Epstein back on here. The reason Boris was looking at his phone is that he's kind of one of the guys that's spending a lot of time on this. His phone was blowing up. We're trying to get him to get an assessment of what's happening and come back. But I want to go to Dr. Peter Navarro. Before Dr. Navarro, I want to bring you on. Also, our favorite guy, Gabriel Sterling, who works for Raffensperger in Georgia, trying to get ahead because they understand once Arizona is done, if it turns out the way that Peter Navarro and others think it's going to turn out, Georgia's next. What did Sterling say in his tweet?
He said, "This audit in Arizona is another step in undermining confidence in elections. This process is neither transparent nor likely legal. Any findings will be highly suspect now that chain of custody has been violated by partisan actors."
Okay, Dr. Peter Navarro, it was your two-hour assessment on the Saturday edition of War Room that people are buzzing about. I wonder if Denver, I know Denver has the one sheets. I want to put up Arizona if they get a chance. I understand we're understaffed.
I got the chart. Okay, fine, put it up, Steve.
Okay, put it up there, sir.
You want to see the chart.
Yeah. Now, Peter, so I want to go through. Hang on. I want to, and Boris is going to be back. This is one thing for our audience, and this is what we had the Democrat on breaky this morning that said, hey, there's never been an audit done like this, right? All the procedures match what the law in Arizona says, okay? Brakey's a progressive Democrat. He's certainly not a Trump supporter, but he wants free and fair elections. And he mentioned Dr. Peter Navarro's analysis of what happened in Arizona, absent the machines, absent any issue with the machines. This is just kind of the good old-fashioned way that election irregularities take place. So Dr. Navarro, as we get Boris back up here to talk about what happened in court, I need you to walk through for our audience exactly what are we talking about when we talk about a hand audit and what do you think will come forward there?
All right. What I'm going to do now is for your radio audience, I'm going to put up a chart, but I will walk you through it. So what we have here are the receipts. We start with the alleged Biden victory margin, which is about 10,000 votes. And then there's a number of different categories of possible illegal voting, and that adds up to 254,000 votes. So what you have is what I call a cheat ratio of about 24 times, 24x. In other words, there's 24 times the amount of potentially illegal votes than the alleged victory margin. So what are some of the interesting categories here? One of them is the ghost voters. That's close to 6,000 voters. Those are the ones where a ballot comes in from an address with somebody's name on it, and that person no longer lives there. And I love starting with that because, as a historical note, it was dead voters and ghost voters that Mayor Richard Daley used in Chicago, 33,000 of them, to steal the election for Kennedy from Nixon. That was a margin of only 9,000 votes in Illinois that Kennedy allegedly won by, and it was all these ghost voters and dead voters. You got illegal aliens, that's about 36,000 votes. You've got absentee ballots cast from addresses other than where the voter legally resides. There's a huge, and this kind of speaks to the Georgia thing as well. It's like mail-in ballots, 150,000 of these, Steve. Mail-in ballots cast by voters registered after the registration deadline. Okay, I mean, that's just beyond the pale. There was 23,000 absentee ballots cast that returned on or before the postmark date, which is the greatest kind of implicit signal of fake manufactured ballots and ballot harvesting. So those are the receipts. I've got a similar one for Mr. Sterling in Georgia, Steve, which shows basically that the Secretary of State in Georgia, Raffensperger, who Sterling works for, basically did not do their job. It's a cesspool there. I think the fact that this guy would even speak at this point is the tell in his con game, because obviously now he's aligned himself with the Rachel Maddow faction. I was just in awe of the propaganda spin that Maddow produced. You have to worry. I want to spend a night with her, Steve, on set, going over these receipts, because I to get in the mind of these people, do they understand that lying systematically in this way to the American public so persistently is eroding the very fabric of our society?
Read Sterling's again and read it about chain of custody. Read that again, Captain.
This audit in Arizona is another step in undermining confidence in elections. This process is neither transparent nor likely legal. Any findings will be highly suspect now that chain of custody has been violated by partisan actors.
Dr. Navarro, when I look at your chart, when I look at your chart of Georgia in the 355,000 mail-in ballots, Michael Patrick Leahy.
I've got it right here. I'm going to put it on.
Put it up. The Georgia Star.
Put it right on the screen right now.
I think on yours it's 300, and Georgia, you've got it as 305.
305,000 ballots.
These have never been.
Then you got 10,000 dead voters.
No, but hang on.
15,000 ghost voters.
Okay, yeah, slow. Stop.
Yep.
I'm robbing the string. Okay. The chain of custody argument is the central argument of the consent decree that Stacey Abrams. This is the signal, not noise. This is what he's trying to get ahead of. What your 305,000 you have up there, Leahy says maybe 355,000, 400,000. There's been no certification sent from the county to the state. To guess where? To Sterling and Raffensperger. Okay? Because of ballot harvesting and other irregularities. The mail-in ballots, right, are the ticking time bomb in Georgia. He understands that. And the chutzpah to use chain of custody, which is his biggest original sin in Georgia, shows you the sophistication of these people in trying to build a media narrative with MSNBC, CNN, and of course the New York Times, as you're cavorting, you're cavorting down there, a conspiracy theorist cavorting in a messy recount in Arizona, Dr. Navarro.
And by the way, I buried the lead. I'm going to put this chart up one more time. The buried lead here is that in Arizona, we had 24 times the amount of illegal votes relative to the victory margin.
Amen.
In Georgia, the Biden victory margin was 11,779 votes. We had over 600,000 possible illegal votes. That's a 51x cheat ratio there. It's the biggest of any of the six battleground states. And Raffensperger and Sterling, I mean, come on, dudes.
It's by the way,
I want to get in the State Farm Arena. I want to get the ballots. I want to get those ballots
Amen,
in
brother.
There. Do the same thing they're doing in Arizona. And look, Steve, this is like nonsense. It's like these are heavily guarded ballots. In Arizona, that they're going to systematically go through in a nonpartisan way, and to throw this shroud of spin around this. To remember what I said on Saturday. What remember what I said about Rachel Maddow? What you called her the den mother right on there, but she's also the grand inoculator, right? The wizard of inoculation.
Right.
If you get my drift
yep,
here.
Yep.
And basically what they're trying to do is inoculate the American public against the certainty, if this judge lets them go forward, and that worries the hell out of me, if the certainty that there will be a different count when it's all said and done, that will I bet the house on this one that basically there's going to be not tens of thousands, but in the 50,000 or more votes that are going to flip because of this. So.
Okay,
hang on.
I'm going to hold you over. We had a lot to go through. We got CDC mask mandates. We got this disaster that's now been visited by the CCP virus in India. We've got the California recall.
India, yeah.
We were going to get Dr. Navarro's take on all of that. Tom Del Bacar, Adam Brandt. We may have to mix it up a bit, ladies and gentlemen, because guess what? There's breaking news out of Maricopa County. And Maricopa County is the center of the political universe. You've heard it here first. Dana Dett, you fought for this. You have not backed down on this. And this is going to happen. One fall, they all fall. Next, with Dr. Peter Navarro in the War Room. Okay, AOC wants a $10 trillion Green New Deal infrastructure plan, not the $2 trillion that Joe Biden's talking about. $10 trillion. What do you think that's going to do to the U.S. dollar? It's going to crush it, okay? You know who knows that? The folks in Beijing. You know what they're doing about it? They're about to launch a digital cryptocurrency that will start to attack the U.S. dollar as the world's prime reserve currency. Now, what does this all mean for you? It means the possibility of economic and financial chaos. So what do you have to do? You have to start to look for alternatives. One alternative you now have to start to consider is precious metals. The people you need to go to for gold and silver is Birch Gold. They got an A-plus rating by the Better Business Bureau. Now, here's what you need to do. Text the following, Bannon, B-A-N-N-O-N, at the following number, 484848. That's Bannon, B-A-N-N-O-N. Text 484848. Do it today. If you do it today, you'll get a 20-page information package that will walk you through all the updates, the pros and cons of starting to include precious metals, gold and silver, in your investment portfolio. Remember, the world's finances are changing daily. You need to keep up with it. That's why you listen to the War Room. Now go to Birch Gold. Here's the following, Bannon, B-A-N-N-O-N, at 484848. Take action. Use your agency. Do it today. Thank you.
War Room, Pandemic, with Stephen K. Bannon.
The epidemic is a demon, and we cannot let this demon hide.
War Room, Pandemic. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Remember, you're not Raheem. You're here more than Raheem's here to look pretty. You're here to work. Okay, so let's get on. Tell me about Maricopa County's blowing up right now. Okay, Boris Epstein and the team are working on it. I think we're going to get a report from Boris later in the show. But remember, ladies and gentlemen, we told you about gain of function in Wuhan on the first show of this back in January 23rd of 2020. Chain of custody. Write that down in your notebook right now. Chain of custody. They're going to come all in. Chain of custody. That's where the fight's going to be. Okay. By the way, Dr. Navarro, we're not going to be able to get to India. I don't think we're going to be able to get to mass because there's so much exploding here. And I do want to get Tom Del Bacar in this segment with you on about California. Talk about history in Arizona. History in California also. The golden boy who they thought was going to waltz into the presidency is now officially going to be recalled. Gavin Newsom, we're going to get to that in a second. Dr. Navarro, you start about the media. What should they brace themselves for of what the media onslaught is going to be like? Since you were in Fort Apache, the White House, with President Trump, particularly you were there in June of 2020. You were the guy every day at work, staying late at night. You saw what happened, what at Lafayette Park. You saw what happened when this city got out of control by Antifa and Black Lives Matter in June. What do you think might happen in Arizona and also the media narrative that people are going to get hit with?
Well, let's be clear about what the first media narrative was while the boss was in the Oval. Basically, it was don't blame the Chinese Communist Party for the CCP virus. Blame Trump. So everything that Rachel Maddow on down did on that side of the media fence was designed to shift the blame to Trump and never mention China. For example, right now, I mean, you can talk about the South African version, you can talk about the UK version, you talk about the Brazilian virus, but you still can't call it the China virus where it started from. So what are they going to do now with this Arizona situation, right? It's like what we've got is a nonpartisan look. It's an historic event. It could give us the best microcosm of our entire election system ever. It's a contribution to history. So what they're going to try to do is put pressure on the judges and to get favorable rulings. So they'll use the legal system, and then they'll use the spin that this is all, I mean, you saw Rachel Maddow. I mean, she, in like 30 seconds, it was conspiracy, QAnon, this, that, and the other thing. It can't possibly be any kind of information that you, the American public, could find any use. I mean, mm-hmm. They're quite vested in this. But we know, I mean, look, I did the three-volume report on peternavarre.com. There's no question in my mind. And the two things, Steve, where you mentioned, there's no question in my mind that the virus came from the Wuhan lab. There's no question in my mind that the election was stolen. What we need to do is get over that hump and basically have the American people understand that. And if that happens, that's pretty much erodes the entire cable news diaspora, not just kind of MSNBC and CNN, but a lot of these other channels now that are never Trump or non-Trump, even if they're playing on the Republican side, and you know who I'm talking about here. Yep. So it's going to be spin all the time. What's interesting is CNN and MSNBC are covering this, doing their spin to inoculate and discredit, but it's crickets pretty much on the other side, other than your great show and OANN. And that speaks volumes, too, about how in this country, the Republican Party still remains the party of the establishment, particularly if they can keep Donald Trump down and out in Mar-a-Lago and Bedminster. So okay. This is an epic battle on here. If that judge, I'm telling you, if that judge pulls a fast one, there's going to be revolution.
There's some issues,
Arizona.
By the way.
The people of Arizona will not put up with that.
The patriots out there and the audience of the show, but I will tell you right now, right down chain of custody, it's going to be an issue that they're going to focus on. Okay. By the way, CNN has got a story up. We can't get it to you today to discuss it. We'll do it tomorrow about how the CCP virus, as personified by Bolsonaro in Brazil, Modi in India now, and Trump in the United States, has crushed the populist movement throughout the world. Okay. We're one of the reasons. Just saying, China, the last thing the CCP wants is populism that comes to the Chinese people. That's why this show is in Mandarin. Okay, we can't get to that, India or the mask. The reason is we're pressed for time. We've got Tom Del Bacar. If we can bring Tom on.